I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We continue the ongoing effort on this program to understand journalism and media, especially the variety available in this part of the world. George Orr joins me now. A lot of the folks you see and hear in the local media business were taught by Mr. Orr at BCIT, where he was an instructor for over 20 years up to the year 2010. He graduated from the same BCIT, then he worked as a reporter at radio station CKNW and at television station CKVU, the CBC, and BCTV from the late 1970s to the 1980s. He's been producing documentaries as of late. You can go on YouTube and see one of his films, Chasing the Dream, The Untold Story of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympic Games. He's an award-winning journalist, winning a Jack Webster Award in 2001, and he received a fellowship from the Webster Foundation the following year. I remember him from the mid-1990s as the host of a short-lived current affairs program, Studio BC, which aired on the Knowledge Network. We'll talk about the media landscape in Vancouver and beyond and more. Please welcome to the Platt on the Line program in studio, as it were, George Orr. Mr. Orr, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
Sounds like I can't hold a job from that description you just ran through.
Well, it's a long career, you know. So.
Yeah, but some people end up retiring from the place they started at. And I didn't end up retiring. I just ended up quitting, but I've been through a fair number of them in the meantime.
You were at public outlets and sort of private outlets, so you have a good idea of what this media market, this landscape is all about from your experience. You were there from the beginning, I guess, or near the beginning, or just after the beginning. Has it changed a great deal in the sort of 40 years or so that you've been in this part of the world?
There's a lot more information out in the world. There's a lot more outlets for information, and I think people have really been, to a large degree, those who choose to be, have been liberated by all this information. I just got a smartphone for Christmas, and my smartphone tells me when stuff happens in the world, so I don't even have to listen to the radio. I can click on something and I can see what's happened in the last 10 minutes, wherever it is, like the bridge overpass in Montreal that had a partial collapse today, or you name it. You know, if it's happened out in the world, I can now stay abreast of it in some fashion. So I think the ability of the media to stay on top of events has been enhanced greatly. The ability of the media to make sense of events has degraded greatly.
So then, what is the future of the media? Will there be a radio stations that we can listen to for news and current affairs, or television newscasts at the end of the day? How does it look 5 years, say, down the road?
I don't think it looks a great deal different in that if you're a broadcaster, you're required to do some information programming.
But part of the license?
Part of the license.
Yeah.
And radio stations make money.
Yeah.
I mean, their business is really to sell furniture or groceries or whatever they're selling, and the same with television. So as long as they can convince somebody to spend some money on advertising, they'll spend a portion of that income to collect and disseminate news. So I don't see it getting, pardon me, I don't see it getting a great deal worse. I just see it getting kind of thinner and thinner and thinner before we started up. We were talking a bit about context.
Yeah.
And I think context is what's evaporated or is evaporating in the business. And so when a politician today stands up and says, we're announcing for the first time that X is happening, most of the reporters there will write it down as though it was the gospel. And there's nobody there to challenge the politician and say, oh, but 20 years ago when you said X was stupid, now you're saying it's great, so square that circle. That sense of critical thinking, I think, is evaporating out of the business, and that's the loss.
So how do we get back to that?
We could turn back the clock. That's always good. It's that pesky internet thing just jumped up and got in the way, and it made everything else so available that you don't have to think anymore. I don't know that we do get back to that. I think that in Canada we're sorely challenged by what I would consider to be an immature media process, in that stations and news outlets hire cheap. They hire well-trained, cheap labor, and they use it until it becomes expensive, and then they replace it with well-trained, cheap labor. And so there's no environment to grow context. There's no commercial benefit to having an old graybeard on staff who's been there for 40 years who actually does know about X from 20 years ago. That person has no concrete value. Because nobody talks about X having changed over the last 20 years, it's not really news. And then if it is Maclean's magazine or something like that, there are still a few institutions that put value in that. But the common everyday run-of-the-mill newsroom, no, I don't see it getting better.
So as a media consumer that I am,
yes, you are.
What are we? I mean, you're obviously you've articulated what we're missing. Do you think people like me want that?
I think there's an unacknowledged hunger for that context. People want to make sense of their world as best they can, and in a democracy where you're supposed to be free to get access to whatever works in terms of making sense, people will take advantage of. I think. To a large degree, they'll take advantage of the best resources available. So if it's not available, they won't necessarily notice the lack terribly. And there's no real market demand to replace, bring back context. I'm getting really depressed by this conversation.
Well, as a media consumer, I'm already depressed, I guess. That's why I invited you here to make it worse.
Well,
no, to break it open and see... perhaps there is a way, with the way things are, for media consumers to be more savvy. Not only media consumers, but say informed citizens, informed voters, or better voters.
I think the best way I can put it in the sense we have an immature media, the infrastructure and support systems around intelligent journalism in Canada, generally speaking, don't exist. I mean, if you watch PBS in the States, they produce exquisite documentary productions that are really important for Americans to know and to understand. There's no such in Canada because the people in this country who've made a lot of money tend not to put it back into things like information programming. They tend to put it into monuments for themselves or foundations that serve a narrower purpose. There is yet to arise in this country a national foundation with a national presence that acknowledges and rewards and encourages good critical thinking in journalism. And I think were that to start up and to be able to snowball and to produce content that ultimately people would want more of, there could be a snowballing, but the external resources to support journalism don't exist in Canada the way they do in Britain, the way they do in Europe, the way they do in the States. And so in that sense, we're an immature country for journalism.
And I guess part of that is the idea that we don't have a culture of media criticism in this country that they do say in the United States, in other English-speaking countries,
yeah.
Where that, I mean, we have ombudsmen at some of the CBC or the Globe and Mail, but that's not really enough in terms of, and it's obviously not the same as, say, a media reporter. I know the Globe and Mail had a pretty good media reporter for some time, who's since left, but I mean, we certainly don't have that in this market.
Oh, no. I mean, the notion that anybody would stand critical of the press in this market, it's anathema. I mean, who's going to tell, what platform will support the telling of that story? Who wants to dump on your competitors? Who wants to dump on the people that are, and when I say dump on, I don't mean, you know, just blindly be rude to, but who wants to critically analyze the performance of the machine we're all driving in the news business? And I think there's a cowardice involved in that. There's a fear that, oh, if we do that, somehow we'll upset the apple cart. Well, the truth is, there isn't an apple cart. It's not like there's some vehicle that requires protection. We don't have a robust media because it's not challenged. And I think to a large degree, because it's controlled the way it is controlled and it's not challenged, it's not going to get robust quickly. I don't know who's going to start it. But if somebody were to start and could find a platform to intelligently analyze the news of the day, it'd be a big, people would watch and listen and read.
Yeah, and we're not talking about like a conspiracy theorists about the big corporations themselves. I mean, this is not, you know, we're not talking about that sort of analysis. You know, just even simple things like if they have a new show, say, on the local radio station, or like the CBC's launched a new magazine program, a Vancouver series, and you know, that's something that's interesting, mm-hmm. Because it's a community program, but I haven't read anything about it anywhere other than, say, the CBC doesn't have very much on it on their own website.
And for some reason, it's a great unwritten rule in the media in Canada that you don't talk about the other media unless they make some just really boneheaded mistake, and then you can kind of rub it in a little bit and call it journalism. But we tend to pretend the competition doesn't exist. And I think that's a huge fault. That is self-generated in the media in Canada. The competition exists all over the place. the fact that in my newsroom today we got beaten by another newsroom, what we do, generally speaking, is we pretend that didn't happen. We cover that story tomorrow as though it just happened.
Yeah.
So we tend to go into it in the from the news business with blinkers on all the time. So, like I say, if somebody were to start it up here and create a... The Canadian Association of Journalists have an annual convention, and that is where journalism gets talked about in a public forum thoughtfully and thoroughly and intelligently, and stories get examined and issues get examined. People from competing environments come together to compare and contrast, and it gets zero coverage in the media.
You see some of the panels on CPAC and the sort at 2 in the morning.
Yeah, because it's interesting content. But the truth is, it gets—I mean, it gets zero coverage because there's,
from the
mainstream press just won't touch it with a barge pole.
Yeah. Well, let me take this chance to plug Jesse Brown and his Canada Land podcast, because he's trying to do that. But the problem is, he's from Toronto, and so generally, what he talks about are Toronto things. So that's a problem there.
And really, I mean, I honestly think we're about 4 or 5 different countries, and Toronto's just 2 countries over.
Exactly.
So, you know, whatever happens there apparently has no value here. I believe it does, but I think in popular wisdom it doesn't. So, you know, that's a Toronto thing. Or even worse, that's a Quebec thing.
Yeah.
So it has no relevance to us here, whereas I think it absolutely should.
Yeah. In terms of the state of the local media business in Vancouver, you know, you talk to people in these various outlets, friends of yours, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Things generally aren't the way they used to be. It's something that we hear a lot. Newsrooms are run on the cheap.
That sounds so harsh when you say it like that. It's true, but it sounds harsh.
Yeah. So I mean, are we underserved as a media consuming culture?
We are woefully underserved. To me, I think the largest story in this decade is going to be resource development in northern BC. Liquefied natural gas, petroleum transport, coal. We still sell a lot of coal. Remember coal, the bad stuff?
Yeah.
Well, resource development happens in rural BC. Journalism happens in urban BC. I don't know one newsroom that's prepared to open a branch plant in Fort St. John. Nobody. Nobody's going to open a station outside of the CBC. Nobody wants to touch Kitimat or Prince Rupert. I mean, there's private radio, but there's no... I mean, if Global were to send a reporter, producer, and a camera person into northern BC and say, cover this story to the exclusion of all else, and that's all you'll do, we would start to be well-served by balanced journalism looking at all sides of that issue. Do we allow a pipeline or not? Do we allow rail or not? But you know, we are urban-based, the major newsrooms. The resource stories that are the big things are rural-based, so they're only touched on when there's a point of contention. The Prime Minister comes to town, somebody stands up behind him with a sign saying, stop oil. So that's the only reference to that story, really. So I'm getting really depressed by this.
So what's the morale like for people that are in the various newsrooms throughout the city?
I think it's really good because, I sort of worked at the feeder end of journalism for a bunch of years, teaching journalism. And you get a classroom full of really bright young men and women who want to work in the business. And then you weed out the ones that want to work in sports. And then you weed out the ones that just want to be famous. And you're still left with about 10 or 15 students every year who really want this. And that's at BCIT. And the same at Langara. So you've got 30, 40, 50 kids a year. I say kids, you know, people under 50. You get 30, 40 of them every year who want to get into the business so bad they can taste it. And so they get their toe in and they're thrilled. I mean, I've got a part-time job at the CBC. And so they're working, you know, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. And and then they burn out while they're gone. And the next crop comes in. So I think the morale inside of newsrooms sort of, it starts, people come in at the bottom and they're full of beans and they're going to, you know, change the world. And after 4 or 5 years, the survivors are kind of gloomy and depressed and probably drink a little too much. It's what the journalism career used to look like when it was 40 years long, but now it's about 4 years long.
Yeah. You mentioned the sort of students that go through BCIT and that you saw. Do you think, there are obviously not enough jobs for everybody that goes through the program, right? So they end up going into PR, I'm assuming, and work for governments or big business, say.
Yep.
So the people that do make it in the news business, are those the best and brightest, do you think? Or
no, or I don't think, and I I say this with some caution. I don't think journalism is about the brightest people in the game. I think it's about the most dogged to do well in this business. I mean, being really intelligent is not necessarily a benefit. You know, it gives you the understanding and the capacity to see things in a larger sense. But if your deadline is in 15 minutes, that has no value. What has value is your ability to shut everything else off, focus on what you need to do, and technically produce what you have to produce. And so if I were to take intelligence on the one end and doggedness on the other end of a continuum, I think good journalists they have both, but they, you know, push comes to shove, they're more dogged than they are book smart. So it's not that intelligence isn't valued, it's just that it gets in the way a lot of the time.
I mean, we've talked about pretty depressing things heretofore. But are you generally hopeful, though?
Yeah, but I'm really ingenuous. I'm really optimistic. I'm the sort of person that, you make the best of what there is in life, period. You know, whether you've got your health or not, whether you've got resources or not. And I tend to think that the world is in the process of getting better. It's just hard to see from this perspective.
In terms of the trends that trouble you about journalism, are those generally ones that we sort of adopt from the United States?
I think to a large degree. I mean,
so if we hear people yelling on cable television, and they've started to do that, say in this country with Sun News, the CBC has that sort of with Lang and O'Leary. Is that not a good thing? Or?
You know, I think to a large degree that is a good thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to use hypotheticals. I hold a strong position to the left of something, and you hold a strong position to the right of something. We can sit and stare at each other and each think the other's an idiot. Or we can start to have a conversation about something other than that. Or we can get into it. And by getting into it, I'm not going to change your position, and you're not going to change mine. But people listening will hear an airing of both perspectives. And I think that airing of both perspectives, whether it's loud and uncivilized or in whatever fashion it happens, I think that has huge value in a democracy. We don't have enough of that in Canada. I mean, we have a sort of looking over the fence and calling the other guy an ass. And I don't think that's public discourse. You know what I'd really like to see? Really, really, really? I would like to see Neil Young and Stephen Harper debate the tar sands one-on-one. Hmm. Three-camera shoot, 90 minutes in the studio, a moderator to keep everybody on track, no answers longer than 90 seconds. I think that would illuminate, it would crystallize, it would amplify the debate, there would be a debate. And it would get huge numbers. Mm-hmm. So everybody, a huge amount of Canada would tune in to appreciate what's going on, whether it's a poo throwing contest or a reasonable date, whatever it might be. I think that's what's really missing in this country: the ability, the courage of those who hold positions of power to defend them in an environment where they're robustly challenged. There's a huge fear in this country by politicians that to be challenged is somehow to be held as less than perfect, and no politician wants to be less than perfect. I don't know if you saw it last week. The governor of New Jersey had a news conference. Mm-hmm. I watched it. 2 hours. He answered every question. He was categorical. He was forthright. He was amazing. I presume he was telling the truth. He set the bar really high, I think, for people in power to be involved in public discourse, and I would love to see a politician in Canada with that degree of courage.
I'm not picking on Stephen Harper, but he's the most conspicuous example we have in terms of politicians of this sort of ilk in this country that will avoid the press, that won't have press conferences, that won't even sit for year-end interviews anymore. Yeah. I mean, we can blame him for closing the door or not being forthcoming, but at the same time, don't you think the media has a part to play in that they're not? I mean, are they demanding, say, access to the Prime Minister?
While I was working on my Olympic documentary, I probably went to maybe a dozen Prime Ministerial news events.
Yeah.
And that's a little categorical. I cannot think of times when I've seen a more submissive, docile, managed group of sheep than the national media. And I was mortified. I was embarrassed. But I was also not somebody from a recognized media outlet, so I would not get to ask a question. The little grunt from the PR office would come out and say, "Now, who's got a question?" And he'd go to CBC and CTV and the Globe and the Star and somebody else and somebody from Quebec, and they would each get a question. No follow-ups. One question, no follow-ups, and then he would only recognize those people. And the rest of the press put up with it and pretended it was normal. And I found that just offensive.
Yeah, but that happens also, say, when you're covering the mayor or the premier or a cabinet minister in British Columbia, right?
Mm-hmm. That's offensive, too.
Yeah. So what happened then, say, from your era to what we have today in terms of how the pack, the media pack, cover politicians?
I think the problem stems, it's the fault of old journalists, it's the fault of men and women my age, the ones who discovered that they're being replaced by the newsroom at the CBC, so they can get somebody to come in and do the same quantity of work at a third of the cost, so people over 50 in journalism tend to get shoved off the end of the bench, and they go into communications, and they realize that the media wants a story, and it doesn't have to be the story, it needs to be a story. And given that it's a story, how about if we write the script for a story before the story happens? That way, no ugly surprises. So we write the script, we tell the politician what to say, they say what they're going to say, they get asked a question, they go back to the script, they say the same thing again and again and again. So the media go away with a story, and the politician feels satisfied, and the media feels satisfied. And, you know, the media's needs are met, and generally it's a news event with lots of time to deadline, unless it's a story that's a little prickly, in which case there's no time to deadline. But it's a media management exercise by recovering journalists who are ruining the business one public relations step at a time. That's the problem.
And certain news can't happen after a certain time, because then it's not going to get covered on, say, the local newscast or...
Yeah, so news yeah. events that you want coverage for are managed in such a way that... I'm constantly, I'm a nag on Twitter with a lot of people in the press. Why will the Premier of BC not publish their agenda on a daily basis? The President of the United States does.
Yeah.
Why will, those sorts of critical questions that would be the foundation of good journalism, journalists in BC just, they don't even want to contemplate the question, let alone address it to somebody in power. And I find that frustrating.
Yeah.
If I was in charge... Which wouldn't be a good thing, so why not?
What do you make of, say, the new 24-hour news station that we have in this market, BC One, the global news 24-hour news channel?
I can recall when I was really young being told, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything. And I can't say anything nice about it. I can't.
What do you watch in terms of media consumption? What do you listen to?
I get up in the morning, I watch CBS This Morning.
Oh, that's a great show with Charlie and Gail and
Because they,
Nora.
They do, from a very jingoistic American perspective, they do news that you need to know, because their first package is 19 minutes long. So I watch 19 minutes of morning news, and then a bit of News World. I listen to CBC. I used to listen to CKNW, but I probably still do. And then... pardon me, I trust my new smart device to tell me what's happening. And then at the end of the day, I watch, wrap up the day's news, which is in essence all the little elements that fell into place over the course of the day. So I don't depend on one thing. I regard myself as an educated news consumer, so I tend to listen. I listen for what's new. I don't need to know any more about pipelines than I think I already know until... something blows up, or something happens that hasn't happened to this point. So I'm constant, like you, I suspect, listening for the what's new part of it. And once I've heard the what's new, I'm done. But I feel like an intelligent news consumer is kind of like a swimming pool that's mostly full of information. So we're looking really for fresh water. We don't fill the pool every day. And I think a lot of people who consume news do fill the pool every day, and they sort of can't make a lot of sense out of it because they don't see that it's really the same stuff every day. It's just a change. This changes a little and that changes a little. I'm not sure how you make a smarter news consumer, but the challenge is there's way too much out there. If you don't have an agenda of how you want to harvest it for yourself, it's just overwhelming. It's like being dropped in a pool and not being able to swim.
Yeah. And in terms of what you read, say, do you read the local papers, the national papers?
I gave up on the Sun about 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
I subscribe to the Globe. I will read the Star on occasion. And then I graze online with a lot of different newspapers, but I don't really... I don't really read that much news anymore.
Yeah. And if you're interested in breaking news, I guess Twitter is the place to go, right?
It's a place to go. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. I have it on my computer, and, you know, every now and then. Like I've got a short attention span, which is why I got into journalism. And so, you know, I'll be working on X, whatever X is, and then, you know, my metaphorical cigarette break is to punch up Twitter, and, you know, I've got 65, so I'll just scan through them and see what's new. And yeah. Generally, there's not much, but on occasion, something, you know, somebody died, something big happens, there's been an earthquake. And so it's a headline service, because most of the Twitter accounts I subscribe to have a journalistic component, so... I essentially use it as a headline service for me.
Yeah, and the people that we read or watch on television generally tend to be reliable on Twitter as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Contrary to current belief, I don't think the internet is laden with misinformation. I mean, there's stuff that you read and you realize the person who wrote this wears tinfoil on their head. But apart from that, I think, generally speaking, if somebody says there's been an earthquake in Bacha Ande, then there probably has been an earthquake in Bacha Ande.
You mentioned you went into the news business because you had a short attention span, but I suspect there was something other than that that led you into this business. I mean, why did you go into journalism all those years ago?
I liked chasing ambulances. I liked chasing ambulances. The notion of what's going on and how would I find out about this without having to go home and turn on the radio. I don't know. Where do news junkies come from?
Yeah.
I don't really know the answers. I've just always been curious, and I finally found a way to satisfy my curiosity and get paid. Wow, what could be better than this? And yeah. I haven't found anything better than this yet.
And you do some journalism still, right?
I do. I worked on my university newspaper when I was at York 1,000 years ago back east. And I really liked that. But we did ponderous stories about ponderous stuff that only young men who think they understand academically everything can do. So we were very self-involved. Then I got in radio news, 40-second long stories, 100 words, tell it all. And after a couple of years, that gets real short. So I got into TV news, a minute 30. See how much information you can cram into a minute 30. And then I get into current affairs, so you get 5 minutes. So the envelope got bigger, but it was never big enough, so I decided I would work in documentaries where the envelope is as big as you want, you can take as long as you want, and not make any money. So that's what I'm doing now, is documentaries that make no money.
But that Olympic one, I've seen bits, I haven't watched it completely, but I've watched it in portions, and it's quite good.
I mean,
have you got anything else that you're working on at the moment that like that?
I'm working on a piece I'm calling The Golden Age of Radio. It's about... I guess it's about post-war private radio and how in every market one station tended to stand up as the place people would listen to and turn to. One station in every market and every community would really tell people not just what's going on with the world, but how to think about it. And the station in this market in Vancouver was CKNW, so I've been shooting and collecting material towards the story for going on 30 years so far. The challenge about telling stories about the media is other media don't want to talk about other media, so I'm not sure where it's going to play, if ever, but it's going to get done because I like the story.
Yeah, yeah. Did you get a lot of response to I mentioned it already, the Olympic documentary?
No. The fascinating thing to me about the Olympics in Vancouver is they never happened.
Yeah.
I mean,
It's four years ago now.
They did happen, but in Australia... In the wake of the Olympics, they set up an entire faculty to study how these events reform a society. So an entire faculty of a university now exists 10 years, 12 years out in Australia to explore the issue of. In Beijing, they reconfigured a great deal of downtown in order to make this happen, and they're still dealing with that reconfiguration. Atlanta went through a whole process of urban development around their Olympics, and in Vancouver, it's as though it never happened. John Furlong disappeared, Jack Poole disappeared, Gordon Campbell disappeared, David Podmore mostly disappeared. The principals who ran this thing vanished out of the public headlines. There's been no downstream effect from it at all. Tourism didn't go up. It's as though it never happened. And I think, to a large degree, Vancouver, that we're that kind of environment, which befuddles me. But so I told a story that I think might be interesting to people in about 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be something about the people in this part of the world, or something in the water. I mean, we've spent the last half an hour or so talking about journalism. I think it's connected, isn't it, to our sort of collective memory? And
I think it is. This is not a city that celebrates culture, period.
Yeah.
For all that we think we're a modern 21st century city, we're a resource town. We don't even have any head offices to speak of. We're sort of a resource branch plant town. We're a shipping town. And so there's no energy to put resources into culture, whether it's a journalism foundation or a grand opera company. We have a symphony, and we've got the Orpheum, and we got something, but we only got one something, and we don't really put a lot of... People don't beat down the door at the Orpheum to get tickets for the concert. This is not a town that celebrates or really engages in culture. Edmonton has a huge, vibrant theater scene. Vancouver, nothing. Next to nothing.
Yeah.
In terms of culture, in terms of journalism, in terms of reflection on who we are as a people. To me, it's an immature, not just journalism environment, but an immature society.
So you travel a lot. I mean, you've got a shirt on that says New York City, so I'm assuming you were there for the marathon.
I was.
Yeah, so, but what brings you back here then?
I bought a house a long time ago when it was cheap. Really? I mean, I'm married to a lovely woman who works at a job she finds absolutely fulfilling, and if it wasn't for that, and my... I wouldn't stick around. I mean, I did one of the interviews I did with my 2010 piece was with an academic in the States who's an urban geographer who said that there's a phenomenon that happens to some places, and he called it resortification, which is an urban environment gets labeled as a great place to go as a traveler. Disneyland, it's the perfect example. Venice, it's another example. You go to Venice because that's where tourists go.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Vancouver because that's where tourists go. There's nothing there except for canals. I mean, Venice is really an open sewer with old buildings around it. But it has a cachet that it markets. Vancouver has the same sort of cachet. It's beautiful, but there's nothing here.
It's not a place to live in?
It's not a place to have a vibrant existence in.
Yeah.
You know, like, we have movie theaters. And we have everything else that a small town in Iowa has. And we have movie theaters. We have a couple of bowling alleys. There's pool halls. There's bars.
Yeah.
And that's it. You know, I spent a week in New York, and we walked, 10 hours a day. And we were just overwhelmed with fascinating things that, what would be neat if Vancouver had one of those? And why don't we have one of those? And we could sure use a couple of those. And, we don't have any of those.
Yeah.
You know. You go to a real big city, you get those. You come here, you get movie theaters and bowling alleys.
Yeah. Well, on that note, on that happy note.
Okay. I appreciate this. It's been very therapeutic. Thank you.
It's been delightful for me to have you in, to come in to do this. I've been an admirer of your work for years. And as I said, I appreciate you coming in to do this, and it's been nice to see you again.
You too. Thank you.
George Orr joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.